BCFM 93.2, the Bristol station you can count on.
Oh yes, boys and girls. It's the Politics Show here on BCFM 93.2. I'm sitting in for Tony Gosling this week. My name, in case you didn't get it, because I didn't tell you it, is Billy Quain. Joining me in the studio this week, I'm delighted to say, we've got two of the vanquished mayoral candidates from the election 6 weeks ago. And Martin Summers, old school Labour economist, is going to be pitching in and helping me drag them over the coals about the hot potatoes that are burning holes in the pockets of Bristolians and beyond. Tony Gosling himself is in Dresden this week, hanging around outside a very fancy hotel, hoping to get a bit of a chinwag with some of the Bilderberg group. Best of luck with that, Tony. We'll be finding out how that went after the 6 o'clock news. Joining me in the studio, I'm delighted to welcome Christine Townsend and Tom Baldwin, both candidates in Bristol's recent mayoral election, and indeed Martin Summers. So if I'm going to bring you all in and welcome you, I'm going to stick your microphones up. Say hello to Bristol, everybody.
Hello, Bristol.
Good. That hello. Is the voice you just heard hello. Of Tom Baldwin. Christine Townsend is the only female voice in the studio. And Martin Summers is grumpily sitting in the corner because I've just made this... I've done it all wrong, haven't I, Martin?
No, you're doing fine.
It's fine. The weather for the week ahead from weather.net is good. There's going to be rain for the garden. There's going to be showers. It's going to remain close, so don't expect to get too much sleep at night time. But there are prolonged spells of good quality sunshine. It's an excellent prelude to a British summer. It hasn't rained very much for the last month, I've noticed. But enough. This is the politics show, not the weather show. First of all, let's start with our two vanquished mayoral candidates, Christine Townsend and Tom Baldwin. May I ask you both, what prompted your decision to run in the election in the first place? Because it's a large undertaking, it's a big commitment, and it's bloody hard work.
Well, it was hard work, but the reason I stood for the Trade Unionist and Socialist Coalition was because I didn't think there was any kind of main candidate that was putting forward policies that ordinary working class and middle class people in this city needed. We had faced £100 million worth of cuts under the last mayor. We've got more coming down the pipeline. In fact, it was announced yesterday by Marvin Rees himself that there's a £100 million shortfall over the course of his term in office now. And that will lead to huge cuts to jobs and to services in this city unless there's a mayor and council that are willing to stand up to it. And that's why I was running, to put the alternative. That's what they should have been doing, really, opposing what this government's doing, refusing to implement the cuts and building a campaign that can push them back.
To hold the hunter to account.
Yeah, exactly.
Christine?
Well, I came back home to live and work in this school, actually. City Academy was the first one I worked in 2003. I'm a teacher by profession. And what I've seen since 2003 has taught me that nobody that was going to stand in this election that's just gone was actually going to put education at front and centre of the table, which is where I felt it needed to be, because we have social selection in our state system. We've always had it. I went to school in Bristol. It existed then. It not only does it still exist, it's expanded under the academised system. But I knew, because of the work that I've been doing over the years and because of some of the boards that I sit on, that there would have been a collective unconscious kind of agreement that so long as every child goes to a good school, then everything's fine in the system. And that isn't the case. A child could go to a good school, but if where you've got concentrations of kids that are growing up in poverty go into the same schools, the Sutton Trust tell us that they underachieve. And there's been two massive reports in the last 18 months from the Sutton Trust, which looks at social mobility and what the impact of education. And it's exactly what's going on in Bristol. The affluent kids are going to certain schools and everybody else goes to the other ones. And it's the schools that need to be held to account, not the parents.
Excellent. Well, I look at, that sounds like a fertile mind to furrow for us as we get through into the hour. And I compliment you both on running energetic and vigorous campaigns and for both getting your deposits back, I believe.
Oh, no.
No?
No.
It would have been nice.
No, you signed that away and you know at the time you're not going to get that money back.
Really? So that's 500 big ones down the drain? Or what? How much is a deposit these days?
It is 500. Yeah. I don't see it as down the drain, though, because I never won, I think simply by being there, we were able to put forward issues that wouldn't otherwise have been heard. You know, we're talking about fight back against austerity, rather than simply allowing the other politicians to claim that there's nothing they can do and they're being forced into it by the Tories. And, you know, I think just by forcing them to engage with those issues and by raising the fact that there was an alternative, we had a positive impact by standing in the election.
There seems to be an unvirtuous circle of everybody pointing at everyone else, saying, you know, the case in point, when George, the new Secretary of the Treasury, not George Osborne, one of the grey men who actually run the country, arrived at the office and his previous incumbent had left him a note saying there's no money. So immediately they seized on that and said, look, 13 years of Labour government have squandered all the cash. And there were £700 billion pumped into the banks, too big to fail. Fred the Shred Goodwin had his sir taken from him. He still lives in a massive gaff and he's still getting paid tons of money by some Scottish life insurance company. Not that it really matters. Nobody was held to account. No single British banker or American banker or even German banker ended up doing any porridge for putting the whole country in penury. And then there's no money, so there's cuts to local council. Bristol City Council faced 150 million or whatever it was straight off the bat in 2010. Tuition fees went up to £9,000 for everybody because that was the maximum you were allowed to charge. And Christine, you were talking about disenfranchising lesser privileged areas of larger cities from educational furtherment. Frankly, a tuition fee of £27,000 over the 3 years, notwithstanding the fact most courses are going to require an Erasmus year, so you get to go and do some work placement and pay £9,000 for the privilege. That's immediately robbing people of everything. And then, of course, the elected mayor has to enforce all of these cuts because there isn't a big cheque being signed by Dawn Primorolo, who was the pay mistress general under Tony Blair and MP for Bristol South, which has been under Labour representation in the Commons for 85 years. And it's still an area of outstanding underprivilege. Partly the reason we have Metrobus. So let's start at the top. Where did the money go?
Well, it was apparently, this is my understanding, but Martin will be able to fill us in on this. It was sort of casino speculation started in the States over the subprime mortgages. So banks were basically, they were lending people money to buy it, to have mortgages that really weren't in a position to be able to lend those, pay that money back. That got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and eventually it just collapsed. And then because British banks and European banks were also, we got such a global market, banks are so interlinked, when the American banks went, that affects everybody else.
Okay, so Tom Chambers, that precipitated a meltdown, which for us meant Bristol City Council sacked all the bin workers, awarded the contract to CETA, then took the contract back off them after they managed to ruin all of the good quality bins that we had, replaced them with rubbish bins, didn't collect them, and then there was a fly infestation in Avonmouth. Am I on the right track with this?
Yeah, that's roughly right. And, you know, that's a kind of standard consequence of privatisation, really. When you're bringing in private companies to run these services, their concern is how much money they can make out of it, be that CETA or Capita or, you know, any one of those outsourcing companies. The profits come first, the quality of the service falls as a result, and in that instance, Bristol City Council took what I think was the right decision in the end, and took that back in-house. But you've seen it in many other places, you know, look in the health service, which is now being pulled apart for privatisation altogether in some respects. When they privatised the cleaning services there, over a few years, the number of cleaners fell in half. That was a result of those companies deciding they wanted to make more money by employing fewer people.
Can we make an argument that the companies needed to rationalise their workforce to fall in line with the living wage?
No, I don't think that is the case. I think, you know, those companies often are ones that are making very large profits, and really what they're trying to do is use the living wage as an excuse to, you know, cut benefits elsewhere and maintain their overall level of profit. And what we think is that, you know, it's the people that work for those companies that are creating the profit. They're the ones that should be sharing in it, rather than having the, you know, the shareholders and the top bosses with their hands in their pockets.
Okay, I would like you to marinate something while I ask Christine a question about education and the profit imperative, which is sneaking into education across the Southwest. Tom, I'm going to accuse you of being a socialist and a trade union.
I am a socialist, yes.
In light of what's happening at the moment in Port Talbot, I would like you to have a think and a rumination on the disintegration of the trade union system in the UK, arguably since Gargle's time and the riots that prompted a strong union to be broken up with extreme violence and some rather nefarious activity. There was an unseen hand at work removing and slandering a number of people who tried to fight the good fight for what was essentially a non-profit making business because of EU open trade agreements, because there was much cheaper raw materials coming in from elsewhere in Europe, Poland in particular. And Germany, even from the Ruhr Valley in Germany as well. Are we seeing that now being replicated with what's happening at Scunthorpe, at Tata, in Port Talbot, and a number of other steelworks around the country, because the market is being saturated by Indian, even though Tata is an Indian company, and Chinese steel, because George Osborne, about 15 months ago, was very proudly brandishing his new trade agreement with China, although they were just dumping an apocalypse of undercut price steel. I'm not going to mention the quality of it, but it was certainly more competitively priced than anything that could be produced in Britain because of energy costs and carbon credits and a whole bunch of that stuff. So you think about that for a minute. That's a really bad question, isn't it? But you're here in front of me, so I want to hear your thoughts on it. Now, Christine, profit imperative, good schools, you say everybody deserves to have one locally. Bristol City Council collects an awful lot of council tax from BS6, BS8, BS9, where many of the younger occupants of those households in the better heeled corners of town will be sent to fee paying schools. And then you have houses, modest enough houses, in the Redland Green catchment area, for instance.
Modest? I disagree, they're modest in the anyway, okay.
Changing hands for anything up to £1 million because they're in the catchment area for the Redland Green school. You know, I live in Seamills, the Brigstow Academy up the road, it's an okay school. The houses aren't going for £1 million. But by the same token, you come down here to BS5, where The need for education, I would argue, is far stronger. But because the revenue isn't coming in from the streets surrounding the academy school down here, is it just being left to fester?
This school, this City Academy, as far as I know, it still is in special measures. It's the only secondary school in the city that is. The vast majority of secondary schools in this city are good or outstanding. right? So the fact is that most children in Bristol go to good or outstanding schools. But what that doesn't translate to is particular groups of children achieving good GCSE grades at the age of 16 and then going on to study good A levels and achieving their potential. What we've actually seen are, since 2008, are four new secondary schools come into the state sector that have taken quite a lot of those children in BS6 and BS8 that would have gone private before, because we've now got the free school, we've now got Redland Green, and we've got Colston Girls and Bristol Cathedral Choir School that were independent and now state funded. So they're also included in the stats.
Right.
So whereas 10 years ago there were a much larger number of children being privately educated, those children are now in the state sector, so they're counted as part of the results for Bristol.
So they're dragging the average up.
Exactly. And there are, Orchard School, what was Monk's Park, for those of us that are kind of Bristolian and old enough to know, that is a good school. But it's not oversubscribed in the way Redland Green is, because what it's about is class. The parents that send their children to Redland Green want their children to be educated with others that are like them. They don't want to send a lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them, they're not interested in sending their children to Orchard. Orchard could be outstanding. There are certain parents in this city that still would not be interested in educating their children in that school. Redland Green was oversubscribed before they even took an exam, because it's about who you're being educated with. And Redland Green is the only school in this city that serves the children of the affluent that has that sort of catchment area that's done on distance. Colston Girls serves largely the children of the affluent, but look where that school is. They're not serving children that they do not allocate their places on distance. Colston Girls. They ring fence 25% of the places for kids that don't live in Bristol, for a start.
Okay. Everybody, Colston Girls School is on Cheltenham Road.
It's on Cheltenham Road. It was independent fee paying until 2008. Mm. It was because Bristol had the two first private schools to become state academies, state funded academies in the country. We set the precedent in this city on fee paying schools becoming academies.
And was that a good idea in your opinion?
At the time, it was presented as being fantastic. If and when, because I believe it will happen, Colston Girls, A, changes its name, but secondly, serves the cross-section of children that are growing up in Bristol, and they allocate all of their places to Bristol children, I think it will become a great school. There is no reason why Colston Girls doesn't allocate its places on distance, because there are enough girls applying distance-wise for it to do it in that way. But it's just that it's been allowed to and wants to continue with this kind of idea that somehow it's different and it's special. It's a state school like all the other state schools, and it should be serving the state. We've got a secondary school place shortage in this city, and we've got a school that ring fences places for kids that don't live in the city.
How much of this do you place at the door of the old LEA, because the LEA really is it's a spent force now with the avalanche of academy schooling, and how much of it do you place at the door of the planning office at Bristol City Council, repeatedly for 30 years allowing the redevelopment of city centre areas, very swanky apartments which are sold. They were sold to people. I used to live down on Coronation Road. All of the stuff that went up on Cumberland Basin and all of the stuff on the other side of the docks from there, that was sold as dream pads for 20-somethings. That was 20 years ago. They're 40 now and they have three kids. They may not still live in that part of town, but there was never any provision in these large-scale redevelopments for educational or societal civic infrastructure.
Well, for me, this is one of the issues with planning, is that it's not just about literally building houses. It's about thinking, OK, what are the facilities? We need to build communities. because it's not just about, I mean, you need somewhere to live, but it's not just about building loads of swanky flats where these people have, A, they've got to be able to get to work if they're in their mid-20s, but what does happen in 10 years' time when a lot of those people are probably going to be thinking about having children? And the idea that planners don't plan ahead, for me, is kind of, I kind of find that, I find it absurd, because they're supposed to be planners and yet they're not actually thinking about the impact that their planning decisions are having on the city. The people that I hold accountable for what's going on at Colston School are the people that run the school and the senior education officers whose only answer thus far is there's nothing we can do about it because it's an academy, which is categorically not true. There are things that can be done. There are levers that exist, regardless of whether it's an academy or not. Levers exist that influence state schools. And because there is a lack of understanding, I believe, at a political level in this city about the difference between academies and state schools, and because Bristol was so poor, politicians locally have just gone, God, I'm really glad we don't have to think about that anymore. And the knowledge that may have been there 10 or 15 years ago about education and education sort of policy has disappeared. And so whatever the officers tell them, this is just me surmising, mind, whatever they're told by the officers, they believe, because the expertise doesn't exist at a political level. And the officers want to sell, well, local authorities and officers need to sell academies' services.
Okay.
Because as an academy, you can go and get your HR services somewhere else, but the local authority education department's only going to be able to exist, you know, and continue to exist if they're able to sell that HR service back to that academy. If all the academies in Bristol decide they're going to go somewhere else, there's going to be a lot of redundancies in the HR department because they're not providing that service anymore.
Well, that probably brings us to a nice point to bring Tom Baldwin back into the discussion, because my layman's understanding, I don't have kids, so I don't need to worry about such fripperies.
Neither do I.
They're not fripperies, and this is the stuff of nightmare for parents up and down the city. They're under mortgage pressure, they're working every hour God sends so that they can try and persuade the bank that they're a good bet to not quite be on time with their mortgage repayments, because that's when they're much more lucrative to the bank. If you pay on time all the time, the bank makes no money out of you. It's the penalty charges they like. But Tom, the academy system is centrally funded. The schools apply to the Department of Education directly without the money being funneled from the Department of Education through the local authority for them to divvy up amongst the schools under their local education authority control. As a trade unionist, the NAS, the
NUT.
NUT and the NASUWT or something?
Yes,
thank you.
Yeah.
I'm nearly there with my education unions. Have they not got an argument to make in one direction or the other about how their profession should be governed from on high? Because most of the teachers I encounter say, I've got too much paperwork to do, I haven't got any time to spend with the kids.
I think that both those unions are opposed to academisation, as I understand it, and you know, I agree with their position, which is based on the fact that this is handing over large degrees of control to private academy sponsors. It is a halfway step towards privatisation in that respect. It allows them to set curricula, to decide on entrance criteria, so it breaks down an ability to plan places across the city, as Christine has just described, really. But also it means that those schools don't have to employ qualified teachers even, and can set their own rates of pay and conditions. And so I think a large part of that programme is about a kind of halfway step towards privatisation, but also weakening the power of the unions to collectively bargain on behalf of their members and make sure that, you know, schools deliver well-paid, well-motivated staff that are trained to do the job properly.
You see, we could, we've picked the scab on that one now, and we could spend the whole hour talking about education in the city. I will come back to it, but what I would like to ask you both first, before we're going to take a piece of music so we can all have a little breath, I think. 44% turnout in the mayoral and the local election recently. It was the first time in living memory, I think, that every councillor's seat was up for grabs in the city. There was the mayoral election and there was something else going on at the same time. I can't remember what the
police
third...
Police and Crime Commissioner.
Thank you. Yes, thank you.
And yeah, it's that memorable.
Our darling Sue managed to get herself back in, despite having squandered millions fighting the corner for a man who... Really, she should have interviewed correctly in the first place. Would it have benefit the city and the electorate as a whole if the age of franchise had been dropped to 16? And would it have motivated exactly the people whose future we're discussing for the last 10 minutes, the people in education hoping to sculpt their own future through further education, apprenticeships or whatever else, would it have helped mobilise the city to lower the franchise to include them?
I don't know how much it would have affected the outcome of the election itself, but it would have helped the process of making it more representative of people's views in the city, I think. I'm absolutely in favour of dropping the voting age to 16 at least. You know, people are expected, if they work, to contribute taxes at the age of 16. They're able to do a whole lot of things, but not to have a say over how those things are run. And I think it's absolutely right that they should be given that say.
Good. Christine?
Yeah, I'm a supporter of voting at the age of 16. I just got a little anecdotal story. 2010, when we got a coalition, was the first time that there were televised leaders' debates. And people might remember that one of those debates was at the Arnolfini, down in the centre.
Yes.
I was working at Orchard School, which was Monk's Park, at that time, and I was teaching something called citizenship, which includes things about the political system. Now, I've been teaching that for over 10 years since it became a statutory subject. That was the most engaged that those students that I'd ever experienced students to be. And the reason for that, it was twofold, I think. One, the debate was on the telly, and it brought it to them in a way that they'd never experienced before. And secondly, it was in their city, so they recognised the places where it was happening. And for me, that demonstrates how interested young people actually are in who is governing and running the city. And there's often this kind of debate about young people aren't interested in politics. Well, when you talk to young people, they're very interested in politics. They're very interested in the fact that, you know, their houses in their area are going up, and they're seeing their mates not being, you know, having to move out into different, you know, further out their field. They don't recognise necessarily that's about politics. They're very interested in the fact that there are, you know, the search, stop and search rates are massively high amongst black and minority ethnic young men. But they don't necessarily recognise that that's a political issue. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you brought it down to the age of 16, you would have much more discussion about these kinds of things in school and say, OK, well, you're 16, very shortly, go and vote and be interested in what it is that the politicians, what is their take on housing? What is their take on policing?
Are politicians terrified to give franchise to 16-year-olds because they'll be held to account by people who have succinct and clear lines of thought? Because you do when you're 16. It's quite visceral.
I think a lot of the politicians would like to go back to previous voting laws where you don't have a universal franchise and only the propertied classes are allowed to vote. But I think they've every reason to be afraid of dropping the voting age. And, you know, I think we can't mistake low voter turnouts amongst young people, as there often are, for apathy, because I think people do care about what's going on around them. They're very angry, in fact, about the future that's being laid out for them by this government and by this system. You know, when they look at the main parties, they're not necessarily seeing any real alternative to that. And so often, you know, people will be turned off by voting, but will go down to a demonstration, you know, go sign a petition to help save their local swimming pool or library or whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. All right, we're going to take we're going to have a comma. I feel like we've been going hell for leather. You're listening to BCFM 93.2. It's the Politics Show. I'm Billy Quain, sitting in for Tony Gosling this week. And now we're going to take a breath with Nat King Cole.
Smile, though your heart is aching. Smile, even though it's breaking. When there are clouds in the sky, you'll get by. If you smile through your fear and sorrow, smile and maybe tomorrow you'll see the sun come shining through for you. Light up your face with gladness. Hide every trace of sadness. Although a tear maybe ever so near, that's the time you must keep on trying. Smile, what's the use of crying? You'll find that life is still worthwhile if you just smile. That's the time you must keep on trying. Smile, what's the use of crying? You'll find that life is still worthwhile if you just smile.
Nice when you can raise a smile, isn't it? Nat King Cole with Smile. It's the Politics Show here on Bristol Community 93.2 FM. My name is Billy Quain. I'm sitting in for Tony Gosling, who's in Dresden this week. So you're having a very European show. Unfortunate for you if you didn't get to register for the European Union. I put my postal ballot in the postbox on the way down here, which opens yet another whole can of political worms, because there's going to be 250,000 people in a field in Somerset who aren't going to be allowed to vote because the well-meaning and well-thought-out founders and runners of the Glastonbury Festival said, would you mind awfully putting a polling station in the festival, because it is the largest conurbation in Somerset for the weekend. And the Electoral Commission said, hell no, you can't do that. Some of you people haven't showered today. Enough about me. Let's go back and talk with two of the vanquished mayoral candidates from the most recent Bristol mayoral election. We've got Christine Townsend and Tom Baldwin. Tom Baldwin, you are, by your own admission, a socialist and a trade unionist. I posed you a question 10 minutes or so ago about whether or not the rot which set in the British trade union movement after the breaking of the miners' strike is now paying dividends for 4,500 people in South Wales. Is the steelworkers' union too strong for the business to be profitable?
I don't think it's a case of the union being too strong. I think it's more a case of the bosses being too greedy. And, you know, we've seen that elsewhere as well. their interest is making the most possible profit. They can make more by making steel more cheaply abroad in lower wage economies. And you mentioned earlier, you know, imports of steel from China and from India. But I think, you know, that you mentioned a collapse or a disintegration of the trade union movement in Britain. I wouldn't say that that is the case by any means. There's 6 million or so members of TUC affiliated unions, still remains potentially a very powerful force, but it is a lot weaker than it was. That was a very deliberate policy of the Tories during the miners' strike, but unions have since been shackled with additional anti-union legislation and other things as well, including the Act that was passed, you know, just earlier this year. I would say in relation to the steel industry, though, what's needed is the nationalisation of the steel industry. Those jobs are very skilled. This, you know, tens of thousands of jobs and a lot more people that are supported by them. Actually, the enormous cost that it would be to the taxpayer of paying those people dull, of, you know, losing taxes and everything else, that in and of itself should be enough to justify the nationalisation of the steel industry to protect those jobs.
Would that fall foul, in your opinion, of EU competition rules? Because if it was a nationalised steel industry, projects like HS2 or indeed the Metrobus would be expected to use British-produced steel.
It probably would fall foul of EU laws, and, you know, EU laws forbid nationalisation in a lot of cases, in fact encourage privatisation of industries and of services, and the EU really is a stitch-up between the big business class of Europe in order to push exactly that type of agenda, and that's actually why in the referendum in June I'll be voting to leave the EU, a position that surprises some people maybe. Because, you know, a lot in the mainstream press, a lot of the arguments you hear for that are coming from the right wing, are quite xenophobic. Actually, I'm in favour of international solidarity, but between working people, and I don't think that's what the EU represents. Like I say, it's a stitch-up between the super rich, and it's actually, you know, putting a lot of anti-working class policies forward, you know, most particularly in Greece, for example, where they've been at the sharp point of driving through horrendous austerity attacks on that country.
They were paying fairly decadent pensions to a lot of people who didn't do an awful lot of work even when they were working.
Well, I don't know that that is the case. I wouldn't say decadent, certainly. And if you look at the kind of social collapse that it has meant in some parts of Greece, you've seen the importance of keeping those things. You know, there are parts of the island where young people are returning back from cities really to work their land with their grandparents in order to eke out a living. You know, there's been large-scale emigration amongst a certain generation from Greece. You know, we're seeing kind of social disintegration in parts of that country. You know, what happened in Greece was a result, really, of what we've already talked about, the global capitalist crisis detonated by the greed of and the speculation of some of the bankers, but actually, you know, a crisis that was waiting to happen is written into the workings of capitalism, which is a system based on exploitation for profit.
Okay, we can climb down off the soapbox for a second, because I want to ask you a slightly more pointed question about the two-way street, which doesn't seem to be that evenly spread, with EDF, owned by the French government, using George Osborne as a bargaining tool to get Chinese money in, with £2 billion of British government expenditure for a hole in the ground in Somerset.
Sorry. Sorry, so what was you asking
well,
about it?
I mean, we were arguing, we hit on the fact that maybe nationalise British steel and pay the premium to keep the jobs in the UK, because the trickle-down effect of keeping people employed means that there's more money spreading out across the broader economy locally and nationally. Which would mean HS2, for instance, or any new civic building project or infrastructure building project like Metrobus would be obligated to use British steel, even though it may not be the most cost-effective method. But we now have a scenario where 15 years on, Hinkley Point C is still a massive hole in the ground. Every MP is hopping up and down. The chairman of EDF has been dragged in front of the Commons Committee several times, the Commons Energy Committee several times, and the French government are saying, eh, because they own the company. And, you know, part of the saturation of Chinese steel on the British market, on the international market, is to do with the trade agreements that George Osborne came back from China with 15 months ago when he went out to secure funding for a nuclear power station in the UK. That seems rather myopic to me.
Well, in some ways, if it remained a hole in the ground, that may be the better option. I think it's a hugely expensive white elephant. I think the agreements that George Osborne came to build it see us paying, you know, a huge premium per megawatt hour over what the current rate is, particularly when you consider the falling of oil prices, really due to the malaise that the world economy is still in. But I mean, you know, they've looked around and looked for what they can at least pass off as the cheapest deal. But you know, you're right. EDF is a French state-owned company. You know, I would say if we're going to be building power plants, we should have, you know, publicly owned stuff in this country where, you know, the money's coming back here rather than filling the pockets of some private shareholder or, you know, being taken off elsewhere as well. But, you know, I wouldn't say that nuclear energy is the alternative that we should be looking for. But that's maybe another issue.
You were both mayoral candidates, so you will have done your homework on the good energy company, Bristol Energy. Green's capital a couple of years back, £8.3 million came out of some coffers and was spent. And nobody knows on what. Christine Townsend, what has your homework uncovered about green capital and green energy in the city? Because there was the debacle with the insulation company, again private tender subsidized by the council, which ruined people's houses. The council had to step in and dig that one out as well.
Well, it was deliberate to create a private company so that the money that, because it was local money and then some central money, couldn't be followed and it couldn't be tracked. And we've got 600 invoices that have just been published. Marvin's published some invoices, and it's a small amount. It's not the total amount of the green capital money, but it's some. And it's exposing things like the fog bridge installation on Perros Bridge costing 40-odd grand. I don't understand what that has got to do with sustainability. I've got no idea. The other big one that was in the press was
the musical tree.
From the tree on the Downs that, you know, they were going to tape some nuts falling, and then they realise actually this year this tree doesn't give nuts, and that was over £30,000. And I mean, I go to some of my neighbourhood partnership meetings. The neighbourhood partnerships got £10,000 each, and there's only 14 in the city, and they got £10,000 each, and that was for the community groups and the people living in those areas to choose how to spend that. To choose what to spend it on, but you could choose what to spend it on so long as it was an art project. You know, there's that whale that cost tens of thousands of pounds. Art is important, culture is important, but so was insulating people's houses, so was getting solar panels on buildings owned by the city council.
Now you've hit the button.
What I'm interested in is, where is the legacy?
Yeah.
Where is the legacy for this? And the thing is that when that question was asked of George Ferguson during this campaign, the only thing he could speak about was what happened in schools. Now, what I'm interested in is, okay, is this year, are those schools teaching those same things? Because I've got a feeling that they probably aren't, and that it was a one-year thing.
Okay, well, you were an educator at the Orchard Academy. You may well still be, I don't know. How many solar panels are on the roof of the Orchard Academy?
None, to my awareness, I'm aware of.
You were an educator in the City Academy, where we're speaking to you from. How many solar panels are on the roof of
the building? I'm not aware that they've got any.
George Ferguson said he wanted every council building to be sustainable, preferably using solar. How many in the 4.5 or how many ever years he was running the city, how many council buildings are self-sustainable for their electricity needs?
I don't know, but I'm going to guess zero.
Nice job, George. Tom, you want to come in on this? Because he talked a good game.
Yeah.
You know, you have to hand it to the man. When the original mayor, Bristol's first mayoral election, there was a malaise. The Lib Dems were, frankly, unvotable. Not unelectable, just unvotable, because Nick Clegg had proved the entire party to be a bunch of massive liars. And for the first time since poll tax, had precipitated nationwide riots over his backing down on tuition fees. So, you know, where did it all go wrong? Let's pick through the bones of George's incumbency, shall we? Because you've done your homework on this more than I have.
Well, I think he came in largely on the back of an anti-politician feeling. People looked at the three main parties. What they were offering at the time was very similar, was, you know, attacks on people's living standards and everything else. People considered them to be untrustworthy. And along came George. He said, I'm not a politician, despite having been in the Liberal Democrats not that long previously.
Well, that was 30 years previous.
Well, as a councillor, I think he'd been a member of theirs more recently than that. But anyway, you know, he said he's putting Bristol first. And that won a lot of people over. And, you know, what we actually discovered is he was putting himself first.
Well, at the time, we had no reason to disbelieve him. I mentioned I used to live on Coronation Road, mid-90s. It was dreadful. It was a great place if you wanted a punch in the head after a couple of pints, or if you wanted a Chinese takeaway. It's now positively gentrified. You will not get a house in Southville for less than £300,000.
Yeah. Is that much better now? I mean, you've gone to being somewhere that you don't want to go, to somewhere where you've no chance of going. So, you know, I don't think gentrification benefits everyone. And, you know, improvement and pricing people out are two different things. But I think, you know, returning to the Green Capital, actually that was quite indicative of Ferguson's mayorship, in that it was an enormously squandered opportunity. We had this money coming in. We don't even know where the majority of it went. Certainly not on things that have left any positive lasting legacy. And that was, of course, happening at a time when we were having the budgets cut from central government. And he was telling us, well, there was no option but to pass on those costs. And we've seen huge cuts made. You know, he made over £100 million of cuts to the city's budgets. Planned things like closing libraries. The one library that he did manage to close, because there were successful campaigns that kept the rest, he said it was being closed to save £60,000 to £65,000 a year, i.e. a whale and a half, on the basis of this. Now, you know, those whales were only there a few weeks. I think that keeping the library open would have been a more useful... you know, that obviously that Green Capital money was for spending on that, but it just goes to show, at a time when we're being told that there's no money, they're busy spunking it on stuff that probably doesn't help a great deal.
Naughty. To be fair, the whales still do exist, and they are now on the portway on the old Bristol and West sports field, which was lay derelict for years after a fire and a number of fudged planning applications.
I think it would be better to put solar panels there, though, and to create some electricity.
Well, I think maybe stick the solar panels on the top of already fairly ugly buildings.
Yeah, that as well.
Bristol has a lot of those.
And that as well, and, you know, not record nuts falling from trees.
Yeah, I think, yes, you're probably right. Okay, look, we're getting close enough to 6 o'clock. Let's talk about Metrobus, because genuinely, I see no obvious reason for it. Three services an hour, 200 million quid, it's already behind schedule, it's already over budget. Phil Mann from Bristol City Council, I must admire the man, he has skin like a crocodile, because everything seems to bounce off him. Let's talk about Metrobus, where do you both stand on it?
I'm in favour of improving the city's transport network. I don't know that Metrobus is, though, to be honest. Like you say, it's only one bus route. There's already a park and ride scheme from the outside of the south of the city. I think, you know, it would have been far better using the money to improve the bus and the light rail services across the whole of the city. I mean, it's creating a huge amount of disruption at the moment. often, you know, any building project of this nature is going to, and sometimes it's worth a bit of short-term pain if it's going to make the necessary improvements in the long term. But like I say, I don't think Metrobus is. I think it's something of a white elephant.
Refurbishing extant Victorian infrastructure, which is already there, would have cost a fraction of this and would have provided a rail link and a loop that goes all the way around the city, all the way down as far as Portishead. Would it have been perhaps a better idea, given the fact that they were 20 groups unified in a single voice, begging George not to go through with this, to have just have had a rethink, grow a bit of backbone and have a rethink?
Yeah, I think it would have been a better idea to do that. And, you know, the rail networks are scandalously underused in this city. They're a great resource, potentially. But I think, you know, part of the problem here is that we're dealing with transport that's run for profit and not for people's needs. And schemes like Metrobus amount partly to a large subsidy to the private companies that will be profiting from running some of those. I think that they should be taken into public ownership so that it's the people of Bristol that are getting the benefit of that, and so that we can democratically decide on the fares, the routes that are needed, based on, like I say, what people need.
Christine Townsend, is Metrobus going to deliver this social mobility and economic freedom that we've been promised, getting people from where the jobs are, getting people from where the jobs aren't to where the jobs are, i.e. north to south across the city?
Well, are the jobs in the north?
Well, with the MOD up there, you could say yes. The aerospace industry, you could say yes. The MAL, that's a relatively big employer. Because all of the manufacturing industry, the tobacco and all of that, that used to be on the south side of town, it's no longer there.
The MOD has got a train station there already, Abbey Wood. There was never a question that it wouldn't have a train station. And where does that go? It goes into Temple Meads. I would be shocked if there is not a high percentage of people that work at the MOD that don't live in Bristol. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing I would say. I think they're coming in from all over, and I think that that is why the MOD located it where it is, because they got a rail line in from Temple Meads that gives you access to a large area, and it's right on the motorway. That is not a coincidence that that's where that was built. Retail jobs, low end. Is that the kind of I want better for the young people that are growing up in South Bristol than to get on a bus and go and work in Cribbs Causeway.
I'm not being disparaging about people from Hengrove or Withywood, but how many of those are going to become aeronautical engineers?
Well, none, unless they got the opportunities to do that. But if the infrastructure is taking them through to Cribbs Causeway to go and work in shops in the Mall, then that is the expectation, isn't it? It's kind of, here's a notch up, you can go and get a job and work at the Mall. I find that quite sad. In the way that I find Merchant Academy, which is, you know, so say a flagship school down in the south, they're attached to the army cadets. There's no way that Colston Girls would attach itself to the Army Cadets, and yet it's the same sponsor. There's it's white working class area, and they've attached it to the Army Cadets. There's something above what's going on, and this relates to the Metro bus as well, because it's about where's the unemployment? How do we try and sort this out? It's down in the south. We need to up the aspirations of people in the south, so let's give them some transport, never mind what that aspiration looks like.
So is the argument we should start with education before we start with transport, or is this a step in the right direction, you think, for greater mobility in and out of the city and moving people from where there isn't work to where there is work?
Well, basically, what are they doing? They're building roads that buses go on, that a certain type of bus goes on. Well, we've got plenty, you know, just build some more roads so that we can have some more buses. I don't understand why it needs to be this particular type of road that this particular type of bus can go on, because they can only go, you know, it's like there's some kind of rail on it. And I understand that they haven't got a contractor yet, because you can't put normal buses on this.
Well, it was based on the model which is in Leeds or Sheffield, I think. Bristol's favourite bus company, First, seemed to have the contract there. Incidentally, First also have the subsidy to run the Severn Beach Railway, which I would say is a fantastic resource. However, the jobs at Avonmouth, and there are a lot of jobs at Avonmouth, and there are a lot of jobs on the former Bristol City Council site at Portbury Docks as well. I'm glad we didn't mention the docks this evening, because frankly we'd be here till midnight. There's railway lines running down both sides of the River Avon. Why don't we just put people on that instead of blowing 200 million quid, ruining all of the allotments, getting everybody's back up? Every single car driver in the city is thanking nobody for sitting at a standstill for 2 hours every day.
Well, I mean, I agree with you. I don't understand what the attraction is about the Metro bus. I don't understand why it has a particular type of vehicle that only can go on this particular type of road. Why don't we, you know, it's like, just build a few more roads and put some buses on it. And then not only can those buses go on all the other types of roads, but, you're creating bus lanes. What's the difference? I really don't understand.
No, we're going to move on to a couple of topics. I just want to garner your thoughts on the St. Paul's Carnival being cancelled yet again. Because it was nice. I fear that the health and safety police may have gotten involved a bit. I never particularly felt safe after sundown there. What's the problem? Because everybody says, we definitely want this, and then the council says, we don't have faith in the committee. And then there's a new committee and say, yeah, we're not giving you license for that either. So, come on, let's talk about this.
I think it's a very positive thing for Bristol, the St. Paul's Carnival, when it happens. I think it brings people together of all different backgrounds. It's a great day out. And it's a real shame that it's not happening again this year. As the £100 million extra spending cuts that are going to happen under Marvin Rees's mayorship come through, I think we're going to see even less support from the council for things like that, which is a real shame. But I'd also like to compare or to repeat something that the organisers of St Paul's Carnival themselves have raised, which is they were asked by the police to help contribute to the costs of policing that event, whereas you compare that to the fact that the police brought in people from forces all around the area, spent £100,000 last Saturday in order to protect 20 fascists and allow them to march through the streets trying to spread their message of hate. I think that's entirely back to front priorities as far as the police are concerned.
Good. Noted. Christine?
Well, I'm interested that you're saying that the police are asking for some of the funding. I would be interested then, do the police also get a contribution from the football Bristol City and Bristol Rovers? Because, that costs a lot. And I don't go to watch football, so, there's that kind of question. I understand that Marvin is looking to bring it back. He did say that he wants to do that, and I commend him for doing that. And I think that it's fundamental that we get this back. It's part of our culture. It's part of, all of those sorts of things.
Excellent.
But
I'm going to have to cut you off, Christine. It's time for the 6 o'clock news.
Okay.
It's been great having you both in, Christine Townsend and Tom Baldwin. Thank you.
Live from the Sky News Centre.